Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up over the next half hour, prayer can change history. One of the favorite phrases of Italian Capuchin friar Padre Pio of Pietralcina. We remember this recently canonized saint on the 40th anniversary of his death. And with financial markets in turmoil and thousands of jobs lost, we turn to the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops for insight into what Catholics should be thinking about as they approach the ballot boxes in November's presidential election. Millions of Catholics around the world are devoted to him, and thousands can thank him for providing dignified and professional health care when they had nowhere else to turn. Padre Pio of Pietralcina died on September 23, 1968, but his legacy looks likely to endure for decades to come. This humble Capuchin priest, who many will remember for bearing the stigmata, the visible signs of Christ's passion, spent most of his life in the southeastern Italian town of San Giovanni Rotondo. Made a saint by Pope John Paul II in 2002, Padre Pio helped build the Home for Relief from Suffering, a large hospital that treats patients from all over Italy and abroad for a wide variety of illnesses. Well, I sat down with Father Gianluigi Pasquale, a Franciscan Capuchin friar of Padre Pio's own order, and author of the book Secrets of a Soul, Padre Pio's Letters to His Spiritual Directors. Father Pasquale told me that he had never taken much of an interest in Padre Pio until he was asked by his superior to prepare a series of conferences on the Capuchin friar. Father Pasquale was living in Germany at the time, and his task was to prepare German pilgrims who were coming to Italy for the beatification celebrations for Padre Pio. He confided to me that he was really taken aback by his superior's order, but that it soon became a very personal passion as he learned more and more about this simple priest from Pietralcina.
I answered to the superior, Paolo Stervite, I don't know nothing about Padre Pio, because I never read nothing about him. And he told me, you have to start. And I asked, why? Because even though you are not keen on Padre Pio, you are an Italian man, and so you have the facilities and the abilities to read his writings. So I started to read the letters, the famous epistolario, the collection of his letters, and I prepared two sermons in German. And I give these two sermons in Liebfrauen, which is a very famous Catholic church in Frankfurt, from the Capuchins there. It's a sanctuary, a shrine, actually. And there was in the church a Jesuit father. I didn't know that there was a Jesuit father, von München, the director of the review Geist und Leben, which means in English life and spirituality. And he recorded my conference in German, and he printed it.
He printed it?
Yes, oh, in this review. Hmm. And with a very big surprise, when I came back here in Rome, I was in Rome also to finish my doctorate at the Gregorian University, I saw the two articles. And this article were read in Milan from the director of the Paulinist Publishers House in Milan, Dr. Elio Guerriero, and he called me, asking me, would you like to write some books about Padre Pio, because you have discovered the mystic of Padre Pio. That was my first link. And since then, I felt myself to be very, very protected from Padre Pio, very, very protected. I got in touch with him in a very, very deep way.
You say Padre Pio died in 1968, How old were you then? Were you even born?
I was born just a year before, 1967.
1967. Yes. You didn't have any way to know him except through these letters.
Exactly, exactly. And through these letters, I discovered two very particular characteristics of Padre Pio, that he has a very deep spirituality, which is named mystic or mystagogic, which means to lead people with the possibilities to be in touch with God. That is the mystic. And I would say that Padre Pio could be in the future a doctor of the Church, but the main point, according to my point of view, which characterized Padre Pio, is that it was the first priest in the history of the Church, and also in the history of the world, who was stigmatized, who has the stigmata. Because the first one, everybody knows, that was St. Francis of Assisi, and Padre Pio, as Capuchin, is also a Franciscan, but St. Francis of Assisi was not a priest, was a deacon. Afterwards, there was a poor Claire Capuchins, Santa Veronica Giuliani, who had the stigmata in the 17th century, but the first Catholic priest, the first priest in absolute way of thinking, was Padre Pio. That means, according with my theological point of view, that to be priest stigmatized for Padre Pio belongs to be a part of Christ suffering on the Holy Cross, because a priest who has the stigmata is not like to be a normal man like St. Francis, which is also holy, or Santa Veronica Giuliani.
You said that you think that he could become a doctor of the Church. Why do you say that?
Normally, the Catholic Church declares somebody doctor of the Church when they have a very own particular spirituality. And the Padre Pio, according to my theological point of view, has his own spirituality, which is to participate to the suffering, to the sufferings, to the penance with Jesus Christ on the Holy Cross. In fact, he received the stigmata, or the wound, on the 18 September 1918, just 4 days after the feast of elevation of the Holy Cross, which is on our calendar on 14th of September, and just 1 day before the 17th of September, when St. Francis received his first stigmata. And he was in the choir. After taking Holy Communion, he was alone, just in front of the Holy Cross, and he heard, as he has written his letters, the voice of Jesus Christ saying, "Would you like to take part to my sufferings for the world, for the human being?" And he said yes. And just in order to answer to your question, it happens during the First World War, 1918.
The First World War.
Exactly.
And he also lived through the Second World War. How did he live those two experiences?
In his letter, it is quite easy to find out, and it is quite understandable, that he participated with sufferings for the destruction. So many families were destroyed from this Second World War, and he participated with his silence. If we well remember what happened in the history of the Church for Padre Pio, in that years, the Congregation of the Holy Faith asked him to stay in silence starting from 1939 up to 1946. It is not interesting to realize that is just the time when the Second World War happened. So he, with his obedience to the Catholic Church, he participated, to be in silence, because he was asked not to hear more confession, not to celebrate the Holy Mass in public.
Because there were some doubts about his authenticity, right?
Exactly, mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. With his obedience, deep obedience with the Catholic Church, he has always said, I want to be obedient to the Catholic Church. The newspaper of the Holy See, L'Osservatore Romano, has written a very interesting article about these things, because Pope Benedict XVI has opened the old archive, the Archivio Segreto Vaticano.
The secret archives of the Vatican.
Yes, up to 1939. Mm-hmm. There is also a very good surprise and discovering that the Holy See has always had with Padre Pio a very protected behavior. The Holy See has always protected, as soon as possible, the Padre Pio pastoral service, and the apostolic visitator, who was a Carmelite, went to Padre Pio, and he has written a very interesting relationship. We can read the Osservatore Romano, in which he said Padre Pio is only a humble Franciscan, a true Capuchin, and a holy man. Which is, I think, is very important, because that is the voice and the report of the Holy See, not of our other kind of offices, you know.
Did you have the opportunity to read any of the letters that Padre Pio wrote, perhaps during those war years?
Yes, the letters that Padre Pio has written in for his epistolarium, which are now collecting four big volumes. And about these letters, he was always saying, especially to families, men and women who has known during the confessions, to accept what could happen in their life, thinking that God, said Padre Pio, is doctor and medicine in the same time. That is a wonderful expression that I learned from Padre Pio. So the main purpose which we can find out in his letters, I mean the letters of Padre Pio, is just that he was always saying to the families to accept what could happen, and then that our first strength and energy is the prayer. The prayer, as written Padre Pio, could change the world, could change the events, could change really the history. In one letter, he has written that the history is written not from big or important politician, but from the humble people, from the good families, and especially from our prayer.
Father Gianluigi Pasquale is a Franciscan Capuchin friar and author of the book Secrets of a Soul, Padre Pio's letters to his spiritual directors. Turmoil on financial markets, mortgage-heavy banks, a sluggish economy, and a housing market in crisis. The U.S. government is pledging to inject billions of dollars to shore up its wobbly financial system that brought down at least two major international investment firms in the last couple of weeks. Television viewers around the world were shocked to see images of Wall Street brokers and white-collar professionals packing up their offices and hitting the streets looking for new jobs. The crippling economic crisis is one of the top issues on the minds of U.S. voters, who will be turning out in November to elect a new president. Policy advisor for urban economic issues for U.S. bishops, Tom Schellenberger, says the bishops' conference is urging Catholic voters to focus not on political questions such as, are you better off than you were 2 or 4 years ago, Rather, each of us, he says, should enter the voting booth focusing on the ethical and moral dimensions of public policies that affect the whole community. Schellebarger analyzes the moral debate with Emer McCarthy.
In August, we lost another 84,000 jobs. We have growing unemployment. In the first half of 2008, we've lost over 600,000 jobs. So we have a huge number of folks looking for work in the American economy. This is the largest continued loss of jobs, 8 months in a row, continuing declining in workforce in 60 years. So we've put ourselves in a very difficult position of really stagnant growth in the economy.
Indeed, Tom, the economy has been the focus of so many people's attention throughout 2008. The United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, they write, the economy must serve people, not the other way around. Do you feel, as an American citizen, first of all, and obviously also as an expert in your field, that the U.S. economy is serving the people of America?
Well, the economy is an interesting dynamic of how people engage with one another to be able to advance the social concerns of that community. Right now, the American economy is staggering and stuttering. It's basically a consumer growth economy. And the loss of income, it's been a continued loss of income since coming out of the last recession in 2000. So American families, primarily, are trying to figure out how they're going to make it with less money and greater demand for consumer goods. So the family, which is the foundation of society, is being shaped by these social and trying workplace times. We have little in Americans' recent past to be able to deal with this. The American economy needs to be able to figure out how we're going to shift from this post-service economy. We're no longer manufacturing like we've lost hundreds of thousands of manufacturing jobs. So we need to be able to figure out how we're going to redirect through education and employment the growth of American society. And that's what everybody's talking about, because we know that we can't continue the way we are and be able to be the dynamic force we need to be.
Now, of course, globally, the United States of America is looked at as being the inventor and indeed the epitome of the capitalist society. But from the picture that you're painting, Tom, what we're looking at right now is we're looking at many, many families across the United States of America with no income and yet a mortgage to pay, children to feed and clothe, and increasing demands on their already fragile financial position. And if we're also looking at many, many families where perhaps the parents are still working, but they are being increasingly demanded from their employers to work longer hours, therefore putting more pressures on the family. Tom, for people who aren't in the United States, can you tell us, is there any help for families in the United States? Is there any form of social benefits for lower income or unemployed families where there's no income? Or is there any kind of state intervention to help mothers and fathers who have to work to pay the mortgage to take care of their children? Is there any kind of social assistance at all there? And if so, what kind is there?
Well, the social assistance varies from place to place. Let's take a look, for example, on what's called unemployment insurance. The Congress just extended what the traditional 26 weeks of benefits that are available to folks who lose a job. They've extended an extra 13 weeks, and there's talk of extending it again another 13 weeks. But unfortunately, it's a state-federal combination employment on insurance program that only covers about 40% of the American workforce. So a large number of folks that end up losing their job have no recourse other than finding other work, because there is no state support for them. If you are a working family, you do get credit for children. There's a child tax credit that's available. There's also an earned income tax credit for low-income workers that increases their its wage support, basically. So we have some wage support. We have some allowances for raising children. But even with that, there's a difficulty for families in terms of mortgage or rents. For example, if you make the minimum wage here in the United States, which is $6.55, the federal minimum wage, which is about $13,600 a year, you can't rent a fair market value apartment any place in the country for that at that level. For a family of two, the poverty line is $13,000. So you're just above a poverty line if you're a mom of one kid making minimum wage. For a parent with two kids, the poverty wage is $16,000. The poverty line is $16,000. So you're just below the poverty line if you're a minimum wage worker. Apartment, a studio apartment, that is an apartment with no bedroom, would run about $19,000 a year. So you obviously, if you're making 13, you can't pay 19. So there is no place in the United States that you can rent a reasonable, modest apartment on minimum wage. So we need to be able to figure out ways to help folks do that. We do have housing choice vouchers. The federal government assists low-income people with their rent, but it's not a guaranteed right. It's only available to about 3 million people, and there are about 9 million people that need them. So we're about 6 million units short of being able to help everyone. So we need to be able to figure out better ways of making work pay, better ways of making the market responsive to the human needs of families, and we need to be able to figure out ways to support those folks that find themselves squeezed by these conditions.
The first moral dilemma that you bring up, you write that today, without a job that pays a family wage, marriage and starting a family seem impossible. Are you seeing an increment in the amount of people who are choosing not to get married and not to have a family because of their economic conditions?
We find that among low-income Americans, the choice of marriage is really out of the question. And so you find people where the social situation just doesn't allow them to form that marital bond, which has an impact upon children and the way children are raised. And basically, it can actually become generational as poverty can become generational. So we really it is really a very trying time for families as they face these broad social forces that they feel they have no power over and no ability to change. And it's undermining the very crux of society as more and more people choose that they can't afford to marry.
And then, of course, we have the other side of the divide created by the current economic policies. We have the disappearance of the middle classes and the widening gap between the very, very rich and the very, very poor. What's happening here?
Beginning in the 1970s, family income started, while growing, it began favoring those at the very top of the wage scale. But this really exploded in the 1990s. And by the beginning of the 21st century, workers at the very top of the earning scale started consuming all of our economic growth, And for the first time since the Great Depression, since the 1920s, the wage disparity is so large that the middle folks are falling further and further behind. And so there's a great deal of pressure being put on folks in the middle because more and more husbands and wives are working to make up what one income used to where one income used to suffice. So those pressures place greater needs on the busyness of family life. I mean, raising children when both parents are working. Those pressing problems that confront family life are due in a large part to the economic stress that's brought about by today's growing disparity between rich and poor.
Another issue that we need to look at currently, of course, we're in the climate of the final weeks ahead of the U.S. presidential vote. What difference is there, if any, between the economic policies of the two main parties, the Democrats and the Republicans? Does anything differentiate between the two?
Yes, there is. The Republican Party approaches it from a very individual point of view. They believe that government needs to be present to protect the American individuals from fraud and abuse, but for the most part, that businesses need to be freed of regulation and their innovation and creativity supported so that they can create jobs and move the American economy forward. The Democrats, on the other hand, believe that while it's important that businesses not be restricted in terms of direction and growth, but that they seek to build through R&D, through research and development, and to help direct the economy in ways that maintain jobs and approaches within the American economy. So there's a much more structured approach to economics in an economic response among the Democrats, which the Republicans would say restricts and drives business away from the American economy. So they're just two different approaches, all within the American free enterprise system. One looks at the need for more regulation, the Democrats, to be able to direct the economy in certain ways, and the Republicans look to free the economy to be able to make it grow. So there are two distinct approaches to the way the two parties look at economic growth.
What is the Catholic Church in the United States urging voters to look for in so far as what really needs to be done by the next government, the next president, to try and help the economic situation and, above all, the weakest section of society or so badly hurt by the current economic standing?
The bishops are urging Catholic voters to test the policies of governments and candidates' positions against Catholic principles and Catholic teaching. They urge the voters not to focus on political questions of whether and they themselves, individually, are you better off than you were 2 or 4 years ago. But we should enter that voting booth focusing on the whole ethical and moral dimensions of public policies that affect the entire community. Are we better off as a community because of the policies and directions that the individual party and candidates will take us?
Tom Schellebarger is the policy advisor for urban economic issues for the U.S. Catholic bishops. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.